You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency announced that the Trump administration will roll back an Obama-era policy meant to address greenhouse gas emissions at power plants. We'll talk about the impact of the proposed changes.
Now, President Trump recently tweeted a question asking why the Senate isn't investigating fake news in the country. It's one of the latest incidents in a long history of tension between the president and the news media.
Mike Wagner is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He blogs at prowag.me. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with that tweet from President Trump, quoting here, "Why isn't the Senate Intel Committee looking into the fake news networks in our country to see why so much of our news is just made up fake?" A lot of people in the media wondered what to make of that. What did you make of that?
So many things. I think the first question is, what is he referring to? He almost never refers to a particular story or a particular set of facts as being fake. And when he does refer to things that he says are fake, it's usually facts that are incontrovertible facts that make his administration or himself personally look bad. And so he doesn't have a very good track record of being specific about his complaints. So that's one reason. Another reason is the First Amendment. The news media have the right to cover politics, and it's very difficult. And, you know, this can be a critique of the news media. It's very difficult to hold reporters accountable when they do get their facts wrong. A reporter can report something that's not correct and not get into trouble for it, you know, in the way President Trump would like them to get in trouble. A reporter must engage in slander or libel, which basically means they have to know it was false when they reported it. And that has to be proven in a court. And that's a really hard thing to prove, that a reporter knew something was false when they reported it. They might get things wrong, but they usually are getting it wrong because they believe they have the evidence that it's right.
One thing that the media has had trouble with on this particular tweet, I think, is a common question. Is this the president kind of just blowing off steam and joking around? And Sarah Huckabee Sanders, press person for the president on a different issue today, had said, "Hey, media, the president's joking, grow a sense of humor," basically. So is this the president joking around in a jab at the media, or is this the president of the United States calling for an investigation that would potentially silence people in the news media?
I can't read President Trump's mind, so I can just say he tweeted, which is the equivalent of a presidential statement, a question about why a major committee, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, isn't investigating the news media broadly. And so he might have been joking. If he is, it would be helpful to say so.
And then in an interview with former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee on the Trinity Broadcasting Network, the president talked about media coverage of Puerto Rico, the president's handling of Puerto Rico, his visit there. And he says the media didn't give him or the federal response a fair shake in responding to the damage to Puerto Rico. What do you make of media coverage of the president's handling of the hurricane?
It's been pretty negative. And one reason for that is there's still lots of bad news with respect to who's without power, who's without water, the growing death toll, the complaints from public officials in Puerto Rico about the federal response and about President Trump's response in particular. And so it's not surprising that the coverage has been negative. And as was the case with his other general complaints about the news media, he didn't offer an affirmative case. He didn't say, here's what we've done that's so great. Here's the number of homes we've brought back online with electricity. Here's the number of, you know, buildings we've cleared out of stuff that got ruined, you know, by the water. Or here are the number of people we're helping in hospitals. Here's what FEMA is doing. He never really offered that case. And without that evidence, it's hard to report it.
Looking at leaving President Trump in particular out of it now, looking at media coverage of an event like this, regardless of who's in the White House, do you see a herd mentality where, okay, the first reporting's on the initial damage,
right,
and then we start to see a narrative form, positive or negative, and then people in the media kind of follow that? Is that something that you see happen?
Yes, that's something that's fairly common in studies of how the news media approach coverage. And so, you know, phrases like pack journalism or herd mentality, as you said, are often used to describe how reporters cover something. And so usually when something is new, there are a variety of different angles about it as reporters are trying to figure out what the story is. And over a short period of time, those different explanations get winnowed down to one or two prominent explanations. This research predominantly comes from Margie Hershey at Indiana and suggests that when the winnowing happens, reporters tend to report about major issues like why a president won an election or what's the response to a disaster in a pack, and settle on a broad narrative for what it is that means. That's not to say that journalists don't like to look for things outside the narrative and try to find unique stories to tell, but broadly on average, if you were to look at the average story about that issue, it would probably be more likely to fit the PAC's narrative.
We're looking at the latest in the ongoing conflict between president and even candidate Donald Trump and the news media. Mike Wagner is with us from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Fake news is a big catchphrase for quite a while now. It's meant different things. President Trump weighed in on the word fake and fake news in an interview. Here's a listen.
The media is really the word. I think one of the greatest of all terms I've come up with is fake. I guess other people have used it perhaps over the years, but I've never noticed it.
So President Trump coining the concept of fake news, I mean, he played a big role in popularizing it and in changing its meaning. Can you talk about how fake news evolved over the course of the 2016 election up until now?
Well, it now seems to mean, at least when President Trump uses it, anything that he doesn't like. And that's not a great definition to think about the quality of news or what the content of news is. And so, you know, there could be those who would say fake news is news where it's actively invented for some kind of political or economic or social or cultural purpose, where people are lying and spreading conspiracies, spreading rumors, stories, you know, suggesting, for example, one that made the rounds, you know, almost a tragic end, where there was a fake news story that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring in a pizzeria, and someone showed up to that pizzeria with a gun to free the kids. And that's the consequence of fake news, because that story is not real. And there is no secret ring of that thing happening. And so that's fake news, not negative news, not unfair stories, not things that make your side look bad, but things that are not real.
Is the relationship between President Trump and the press getting worse, or was that possible?
I don't think it's getting better. I'm not quite sure if the relationship is wholly bottomed out. I would characterize the relationship as symbiotically contentious. And so it's very negative broadly, but the news media certainly have to report on what the president does, but also get more clicks, page views, viewers, listeners when they're covering President Trump. And one way that President Trump helps himself is by using social media to generate more news coverage. And so when his coverage dips, or when things are in the news that he would like to get off the news, he goes on these little tweet storms, and then the news media typically take that bait and start covering his tweets. The percentage of tweets that get mentioned in a news story is extraordinarily high as compared to any other president or political leader, both in our country and in other places. And so he's very good at controlling that narrative. And so the relationship is symbiotic. He knows how to play the news media in some respects, but the news media also provide him a lot of headaches by reporting things that he says that are false and pointing out things that he promised to do that he hasn't done, and things like that.
Well, I'll read another presidential tweet with that. President Trump tweeted, I think this was this morning, he's had this tiff with Senator, now outgoing Senator Bob Corker, the tweet this morning: the failing New York Times set little, with two D's, little Bob Corker up by recording his conversation, was made to sound a fool, and that's what I'm dealing with. Now, the New York Times and Senator Corker's staff both confirmed that
right.
They both recorded right. It. They both knew each other was recording.
They joked
recording
about
it.
Being on the record, you know, because they knew they were on the record. Mm-hmm. Senator Corker said to the reporter, you know, something to the effect of, you know, you know, I don't love talking to you on the record, but here we are. And they laughed because it was a joke. And I mean, so, that tweet is, in terms of things that are true, are kind of functionally meaningless. The senator knew he was on the record. His staff was recording the interview. President or the New York Times reporter was recording the interview. Corker did this on purpose to say the things that he wanted to say about President Trump. It's the case that as politicians decide that they're leaving office, they tend to lose some of the filters that prevent them from saying things when they have to face re-election or their colleagues in the next legislative session.
Mike Wagner is with us, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He stays with us as we look at the latest developments in the relationship between President Donald Trump and the media.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation. What do you think of President Trump's tweet asking why there isn't an investigation of fake news in the United States? Do you think President Trump's relationship with the media is getting worse? You can join in by posting on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweeting at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our look at the relationship between President Trump and the press. Do you think the relationship is having an effect on discourse in the country? How do you think the press is doing in its coverage of the Trump administration? You can call 800-642-1234 to weigh in. You can also tweet at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Mike Wagner is with us, associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike, picking up where we left off, we were talking about Senator Corker and this rift with President Trump. Now, Senator Corker, one of the things he was talking about was he was worried that President Trump might lead us into war. The tiff that's come out on Twitter and in the media has turned into a story about, oh, this argument between two political figures. Is the way we cover President Trump in the media maybe distracting from actually covering the content and going into more the form, the visible rifts that we see?
I think that's right. Senator Corker is on, you know, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and so he has access to, you know, the kinds of briefings that not all lawmakers have access to with respect to our country's military plans, with respect to threats that face the country from around the world. And by sitting on that committee and then tweeting out, he's worried that the president is marching us toward World War III. That's something that would normally set off alarm bells in the media that cover national defense, national security, the State Department, and things of that nature. And other, you know, lawmakers, Connecticut's Chris Murphy being one, are now tweeting to say, if someone on that committee is sounding this alarm, we should take it really seriously.
On a similar note with the NFL protests, intended to draw attention to racial bias, concerns about policing and minority communities. And our conversation, based in part on how the president responded on Twitter and how that was covered, is conflict between the president and the NFL, the president and the players, the vice president walking out of a game.
And it also kind of engages in a classic political move of reframing a controversy. So the players are kneeling because of their views about police brutality and racial injustice. The president and the vice president have said the players are kneeling because they don't respect the flag, they don't respect veterans, they don't respect police. And that's not what the players themselves say about why they're doing it. And so the president has been successful, I think, at reframing that issue by getting into the conflict in the way that he has.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hi. I was responding to your question a few minutes ago about investigating fake news. Apparently the president wonders why there isn't an investigation. But actually there is. Congress is investigating Facebook and social media news, especially coming from outside our country. Facebook and these other companies are self-investigating what people are putting on there that is actually might be fake news. In terms of the news, the newspapers, the television stations in this country, by law, have to broadcast true news.
John, thanks for the call. So, yeah, point taken that Congress is investigating social media and the actual fake news as originally termed, but say by law, well, there has to be true news.
Reporters cannot report things that they know to be false.
Then they're subject to a libel lawsuit.
Then they're subject to a libel lawsuit or a slander lawsuit, depending upon how they're communicating that thing that's false. But they can get things wrong. They can write opinions, and do those things without fear of a retribution from the government, or at least a successful one in court. It is the case that Congress is interested in the Russian or potential kind of Russian Facebook accounts that were sharing lots of fake news, but that's more of an investigation into how Russia infiltrated or used, I guess I should say, Facebook to share information as compared to what that information was and whether it was true and who it might have affected. They're not quite to that point yet in investigations.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. The problem I have with the president's tweets and anything this president says is that he has such a long noted record of lies going all the way back to his beginnings in business and all the fake news that he's generated himself about the size of his inaugural crowd, about how he, next to Abraham Lincoln, is the greatest president and a historic victory, landslide, all these things that he says that are demonstrably not true. I think this man has no credibility at all. I think he has no moral authority, he has no integrity. He's an embarrassment to this country that a man of his weak moral character can become president of the United States says something about our country that we should be deeply concerned about.
Willem, thanks for the call. How can the media handle misstatements from a leading political figure? I mean, they deal with him all the time, but what do you make of how it's gone through the campaign and now?
Well, I think, you know, a wide variety of news sources, I would say most notably the Washington Post and the New York Times, have been very aggressive in reporting the facts when President Trump says things that are not true, which he has done on many occasions on some issues that are really kind of pointless and small, like this, the crowd size of an inaugural, and others on when he's going to introduce a policy. He regularly will say, you know, we're going to do that next week, and then next week comes and that policy is never introduced or that plan is never shown. And so there are a lot of organizations that are aggressively holding the president's feet to the fire about that. One of the things the president does not enjoy about the coverage he receives.
Talking to Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison, looking at the relationship between President Trump and the media. And we'll go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hi. Well, I agree that most of the media, unfortunately, in these last few years, including public radio, are dealing with trivialities or fake news, particularly, you know, talking about things like who's sitting or standing at a football game when we have unbelievable geopolitical events going on with Turkey and Saudi Arabia realigning with Russia, buying S-400 missile systems. We have China beginning to sell oil for yuan, redeemable in gold, which is the first and a very significant threat to the petrodollar and thus the economic viability, what there is left over of the United States.
I take your point, Jim. So by focusing on maybe the president's statements, the NFL games, the media isn't looking at the serious stuff going on in the world, he says.
Well, it's the case, I think, that the president's behavior and the media's, broadly speaking, the news media's response to it does close the news hole a bit and does shift some things off of the agenda or off of the front page or off of the first block of a radio newscast or a television newscast, big issues like the ones the caller is talking about and others. And so it is the case that President Trump sucks up more oxygen than a lot of other politicians and issues traditionally do. And part of it, I think, is because of the layering of social media onto his strategies. I think that's one reason we see this happening, but it is to the detriment, I think, of other issues that we might care about and having the opportunity to learn about them, which isn't to say they're not being covered, but not being covered as prominently or as often.
I want to make this, thanks for that call. I want to make this a little more complicated, though. We're saying the media, and I'm saying the media a lot. The media is a lot of things.
Yes,
and
it
there's,
is.
You know, any of those stories you mentioned, you can go out and find. It's in
I'll
the
bet they're
papers.
In a newspaper today, right.
And there's, you know, more partisan, intentionally partisan media and less. So is it hard to talk about the media as a singular thing since it's a plural?
It is hard to talk about that, but it is also the case that the front page of the New York Times still has a statistically significant correlational effect on what other news media around the country, local and national, choose to cover. And so elite news media still influence what all the other things that we might call media do. And that's even true for political blogs and things that we think are outside of the traditional media. And so the driver here is still what the traditional mainstream media pay attention to. That doesn't mean it's the only thing that gets paid attention to. It certainly isn't. But it's still an important factor when it comes to the information that we learn about as citizens in a civil democratic society.
One trend I've been noticing lately in a lot of national reporting, places like the Washington Post and elsewhere, when they're covering the Trump administration, where, you know, the lead might be according to a source. Mm-hmm. Now it's, we talked to 15 sources, including this kind of source, this one by name, this one anonymously. What's up with the sort of mass sourcing going on there?
Yeah, you know, I'm not 100% sure if it's in fact an empirical trend, but I've noticed that too as I read stories. Part of it, I think, has to do with different presidential management styles. President Obama was famous for, you know, not wanting drama in his administration, and there were fewer leaks, which reporters did not appreciate. And also, President Obama was aggressive in going after reporters on national security issues. And so that kind of diminished leakers' willingness to leak. Whereas in the Trump administration, there's a mix of people who've been with Trump for a long time and people who've been in Republican politics for a long time. And a lot of those folks are leaking, you know, all the live long day. And they feel, as Senator Corker does, that the things that President Trump is doing are dangerous or wrongheaded, and they want to get that information out. And a lot of those stories are also pretty explosive in nature. And so reporters, knowing that part of President Trump's case is that the news media are not fair, need to make sure that they have these facts locked down from as many sources as possible, because it fits right into the president's narrative to get something wrong. And so I think we might see some outlets being even more careful about reporting anonymously sourced material.
Very briefly, Mike, we're just about a year into this presidency, three quarters of a year. Expect to see anything change anytime soon?
I don't. I expect the president to continue to find ways to change the topic when he doesn't like it and to attack his enemies on social media and with friendly television sources. And I expect the news media to continue aggressively covering the administration.
Mike, as always, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us to look at the latest in President Trump's often conflicted relationship with the media.
Coming up, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency has signed off on a repeal of an Obama-era policy meant to address greenhouse gas emissions. We'll look at what's next. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Now we turn to energy policy. Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt issued a proposed rule that would repeal the Clean Power Plan, which was aimed at curbing greenhouse gas emissions from existing U.S. power plants.
The plan is an Obama-era policy, but had been blocked from taking effect by the U.S. Supreme Court while lower courts assessed lawsuits against it.
Richard Revis is a professor of environmental law in the New York University School of Law, and he's also the author of several books, including Struggling for Air, Power Plants, and The War on Coal. Richard, welcome to Central Time. Richard, are you with us?
I am.
There we go. Now I can hear you. What did you make of this announcement from the EPA?
Well, it wasn't surprising. This was in the air for a long time, so we were expecting it. And what is surprising is the breadth of the attacks on environmental law that are contained in the proposal.
What kind of attacks?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's a proposal to repeal the Clean Power Plan, which is the most significant U.S. regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's very important. But in order to get there, they attack the underpinnings of a lot of environmental regulation. So the Trump administration is trying in this proposal to make the Clean Power Plan's repeal look economically supportable. And the problem is that it is not economically supportable. So in order to make it look economically supportable, they mangle the estimates of costs and benefits so that the costs look much larger than they are, the benefits look a lot lower than they are. But in lowering the benefit estimates, they do damage that would have far-reaching consequences beyond just the Clean Power Plan.
Right, and you wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about this, getting at what you see as a mangling of the numbers to justify the rollback of the Clean Power Plan. Can you take us through some of your argument? For instance, the costs of the plan.
Sure. They mangle both the costs and the benefits. On the cost side, the Clean Power Plan would have led to somewhat more expensive, a more expensive price of electricity per unit of electricity, but it would have also led to energy efficiency measures, which would have led to having less electricity needed. So the total cost of electricity was going to go up as a result of one factor, the higher cost of producing it, but down as a result of another factor, the less amount needed because of energy efficiency improvements. So what the Trump administration does is it fails to consider the energy savings as a cost reduction and just looks at the one factor, the one that increases the cost of electricity. So they then say, as Scott Pruitt said today, that the Clean Power Plan would cost $33 billion a year. But that is only if electricity that is purely imaginary, that would never be produced because it wouldn't be needed, were actually produced and paid for. It is total fiction. Because as I indicated, the Clean Power Plan would lead to savings in the amount of electricity needed as a result of these energy efficiency improvements.
You also say that the EPA reduced estimates to account for domestic impact, just the United States, and not a more global impact. How does that change things?
They do two things. They first, for greenhouse gas emissions, they reduce the benefit estimates, and then they also reduce the benefits estimates of for the health benefits of local pollutants that would be reduced as a result of the Clean Power Plan. So on the greenhouse gas side, there is an estimate of the benefit of greenhouse gas emissions called the social cost of carbon. It's been in place. It was in place during almost all of the Obama administration, and it's required by a decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. And it dates back to 2008. And then in 2016, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago held that the Obama administration's number, which is a global estimate of the global benefits of carbon dioxide emissions, was a reasonable number. So the Trump administration now says that it's not going to use a global number, even though carbon dioxide is a global pollutant and has global adverse impacts. It's going to somehow or other use a subset of that number, a much lower number, which it calls the domestic estimate. But what it calls a domestic estimate overlooks the fact that the U.S. suffers adverse consequences not only from greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, but also from greenhouse gas emissions in other countries. It also overlooks the fact that the U.S. actions in this area have an impact on what other countries do. So if the U.S. acts irresponsibly, it makes it more likely that other countries will act irresponsibly as well, for example, to consider only a number that's domestic from their perspective. And the additional greenhouse gas emissions would have adverse consequences on the United States. So what they call a domestic number is a misnomer. It has no support in economic theory. It is not a real thing. It is just an arbitrary way of cutting down on the estimates, on the proper estimates of the benefits of greenhouse gas reduction.
Richard Revis is a law professor at NYU. He stays with us as we continue to look at the EPA's proposed plan to do away with the Clean Power Plan.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? Should the United States stick with a Clean Power Plan and implement it, or are you glad to see the Trump administration working to overturn it? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll continue the conversation in a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing to look at the future of energy policy under the Trump administration. Richard Revesz stays with us. He's a professor of environmental law at New York University Law School.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. The Trump administration is looking to end the Obama-era policy, the Clean Power Plan, that's been tied up in courts. Do you think that's a good idea, bad idea? Was it overreached by the Obama administration, or was it what the United States needs to do to control climate change pollution? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Richard, I want to ask you, Senate Environment and Public Works Committee Chairman John Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming, said it, meaning the Clean Power Plan, would have hurt energy workers in Wyoming and harmed the state's economy. Is he right about that? How would this have impacted energy workers?
Well, I assume he was referring to people in the coal industry, coal miners, and people generally working in the coal industry. Unfortunately, coal has been in decline for a long time, but it's not primarily because of environmental regulation. Coal has been in decline primarily because of the low prices of natural gas as a result of fracking, and also because of the quick introduction of renewables, which are now a lot cheaper to produce than they used to be. So the Clean Power Plan is not going to have an appreciable, the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, even if it ultimately happens and is ultimately upheld by the courts, which I doubt will be the case, is unlikely to have much of an impact on co-workers in Wyoming or elsewhere.
So what happens to those coal jobs?
Well, that is a serious social problem, and we should be thinking as a society on how to provide opportunities for people who've devoted their lives to these endeavors that now are not economically viable because circumstances have changed. And whether it's retraining, whether it's economic development measures that bring other jobs to the areas or whatever it is, I think that's a serious issue that deserves serious attention, which it's not getting because instead we engage in these acrimonious debates about whether the Obama administration's regulations caused this problem or not. And it's obscuring a serious social problem that is not going away no matter what happens to the Clean Power Plan.
I want to take a caller now. We've got Vic joining us in Amherst Junction. Vic, hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I just wanted to say that I totally think that the Clean Power Plan is future-minded, and I agree with your speaker about the offset. We have to look at, the job losses, and I think that really needs to be seriously looked at. But I kind of think that we can have our cake and eat it too, especially when we look toward the future.
And what are you thinking of when you say that?
Well, what I'm thinking of is I think the job solution is going to take a lot of thought and a lot of time. And I also think that when I think about my kids and the future, that's the other part of, you know, having your cake and eat it too, that we can have clean air. You know, I often ask young kids I teach, and I say, how many of you really want clean air? I mean, there's nobody who says they don't. And this is not the silver bullet, but it is part of a solution, a bigger solution to a problem that we have right now that we have to deal with, and that's greenhouse gases.
Vic, thank you for that call. And Richard, can we have our cake and eat it too when it comes to clean energy and jobs and the economy and all of that?
Definitely. I completely agree with your caller. There is no strong evidence that these environmental regulations in the aggregate lead to a loss in jobs. They might lead to some shifting around of jobs. There are obviously a lot of jobs in the renewable sector, in solar and wind. And as energy shifts in that direction, there are new jobs created. There are also some jobs lost. I mean, most studies show that the impact of regulation on jobs is minimal. In some cases, it's slightly positive, in some cases it's slightly negative, but it's almost always very small. The opponents of regulation raise this jobs issue as some strong argument against regulation, but they're just mangling the economic analysis. I think we can have our cake and eat it, and we must have our cake and eat it, because we're creating very serious global problems by not addressing this issue. If the U.S. doesn't do it, other countries ultimately over the long run won't either. We have to be leaders in this area. And also because these measures to reduce greenhouse gases have enormous health benefits in the United States, because they reduce other pollutants, like particulate matter, that have an impact on public health. So, for example, the Clean Power Plan would save 3,600 lives a year. And even if some jobs would be lost as a result of it, which is not totally clear, it's probably a smaller number. So by delaying it or repealing it, we would create more dead people than unemployed, than the unemployed people who might get their jobs back if there are any of those.
Richard, even without the Clean Power Plan, greenhouse gas emissions are projected to decrease. Is that rate enough?
Well, they have been decreasing so far, and that's because natural gas continues to be cheap and renewables have been introduced at a faster rate than the Obama administration estimates had anticipated. So that's been good. It has not been uniform, so in some states there have not been significant improvements, and others there have been. But it's risky to continue doing this without the regulatory measure, because tomorrow some market condition might change, natural gas might become expensive, and then suddenly we would lose all of these gains. The only way to ensure the gains of the long run is to have a regulatory program in place like the Clean Power Plan.
And as we start to wrap up, Richard, what happens next? Is this a question for the courts?
Well, it will be a question for the courts eventually. So right now, the administration today announced a proposed rule. The next step is it will publish this rule in the Federal Register, maybe in a few days, maybe in a few weeks. Then there'll be a 60-day comment period where any interested party or entity can file comments. There are going to be tons of comments filed on this rule. After that, the agency has a legal obligation to respond to all material comments and explain why it disagrees with them to the extent it disagrees with them. Once it's done with that, it publishes the final rule. And then the final rule will definitely be challenged. Then the case will go to the courts. It'll initially go to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and it could conceivably eventually.
And we leave it there. Richard Rev is with us, a professor of environmental law at the New York University School of Law and the author of several books, including Struggling for Air, Power Plants, and the War on Coal. He joined us for a look at the EPA announcement about a proposed repeal of the Clean Power Plan.
The new state budget makes changes to the food assistance program. Governor Walker wants permission from the federal government to administer drug tests to food share recipients and impose work requirements. Shemaine Mills looks at how this could shift the safety net for people who now rely on government help.
2 years ago, Wisconsin required able-bodied adults to work in order to receive food stamps, known as food share. Thousands were dropped from the program. Now the work requirement has been expanded to parents of school-age children. Eligibility for food share could shrink and reliance on food pantries grow, not only because of state changes, but billions of dollars in proposed cuts at the federal level. All this worries Tammy Butler. She relies on food share to feed herself and her two kids. While waiting in line for free groceries at a rural food pantry in August, she explained she can't work and hasn't been able to get disability benefits either.
I've been waiting for 5 years. I hurt my back. I've got kidney disease, a liver disease. I use the food pantries. You know, I barely make it.
David Lee is executive director of Feeding Wisconsin, a trade group for 6 regional food banks. He's also concerned about changes to food assistance.
The emergency food system was not designed to do the work of the federal government. We are designed to work in partnership to fill in gaps.
Over the years, the social safety net has expanded and contracted as attitudes, politics, and economies changed. When the Great Recession receded, Wisconsin and other states implemented a federal work requirement that had been waived because of lack of jobs. Then in January of this year, Governor Walker announced he would build on the reforms initiated by his predecessor, Tommy Thompson.
You know, we are good and decent people in this state. We will help people when they were down and out, but for those who are able, public assistance should be a trampoline, not a hammock.
At the time, the state's largest business group, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, said the current safety net created a disincentive to work. Companies were having trouble finding employees. David Lee says that's because some can't get to a job or find work that pays the bills.
I think the question on self-reliance is, look, a good job is the best anti-hunger tool, right? The question then becomes, are there good jobs?
A UW-Madison report found poverty is down in the state and unemployment has declined. But Lee says many of the jobs available are only part-time or pay poorly.
The jobs that are coming back are not the jobs that we had pre-recession. They're more lower-wage jobs. People are working less hours.
The state says it's had success in linking food share recipients to jobs and job training. A recent report showed 18,000 food share participants working for an average of 33 hours a week for $12 an hour. All were able-bodied adults without dependents. Governor Walker indicated in January he wanted even more people working for food.
We now want to have adults who have children who are school age enter the workforce as well. And so we're going to, in our proposal, enact a similar requirement that says you need to be employed at least 80 hours a month.
The state report on food share employment showed only 30% of those referred to the work program actually enrolled. Lee says that's not good enough.
We are supportive of programs that help connect people to work, but work training programs have to work.
Advocates for the poor say reforms intended to help may cause some to fall through the cracks as the safety net shifts when state and national policies change. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I have some bittersweet news that I want to share, and there's no easy way to say it, so here it is. I've made the very difficult decision to leave Wisconsin Public Radio. I have had an amazing 21-year career here. I've worked on one of our incredible national programs, to the best of our knowledge. I had my own call-in show on Friday mornings for 5 years, and I started out as an announcer on Weekend Edition and producing for the Tom Clark Show, which is where I met you, Rob Ferris.
Yes, way back in the day.
Yeah, so it's been a wonderful journey, and I'm leaving to pursue a really exciting opportunity in communications, which will be off the air. And I'll also be focusing on one of my new passions, which is coaching speakers and communications and storytelling. So I'm excited about that, too. It has really been, and I mean this, it has really been an honor to sit side by side with the WPR and Central Time community as we share stories and information and we laugh and we sometimes cry together, too. I am going to miss so much about WPR and the incredibly awesome Central Time team. And, of course, I'm always going to have a special place in my heart for the show itself, the show that you and I founded together, Rob. I'm going to miss you.
No, you won't miss. I'll miss you. Like, I just thinking back the early days, sitting in a restaurant, brainstorming this crazy show idea we had.
I know, and here it is.
Making it happen. And you did a lot of great stuff for the show. We did a good thing together. We'll keep doing it. It's not going to be the same without you. I'm really going to miss sharing an office with you.
Yeah.
And pranking each other in the office and doing the show together. Good luck, but it's not going to be the same. I'm going to miss you.
It's going to be tough, but I'm looking forward to keeping on following Central Time as a listener, because it's been an honor to sit side by side in front of the mic with the WPR community and the Central Time community. Now I'm going to be there as a listener.